1992, but it has never been aired. And in fact, it is part one of a four-part series that was never aired anywhere. And it's pretty old. It's an interview with Vladimir Terzisky, and it's about space and UFOs and all that kind of stuff. So once again, tonight's broadcast of The Hour of the Time was originally taped on July 27, 1992, as part one of a four-part series of interviews with Vladimir Terzisky. This series was never aired on The Hour of the Time, or anywhere, for that matter. Nobody has ever heard this before. So, sit back, relax. I don't even remember what it is, except that it covers tonight's topic. July 27th, 1992. I am your host, William Cooper. Just turned in, ladies and gentlemen. This is a broadcast that was originally taped in a hotel room in San Diego, as a matter of fact, on July 27, 1992, as a four-part series of interviews with Vladimir Terzisky. This series was never aired anywhere. Nobody has ever heard it before. And aside from remembering that it has to do with tonight's space topic, I don't really remember what it's about. So we should all enjoy listening to this tape, and if tonight is productive, we'll do the whole series for the next three Friday nights. Once again, welcome to the Hour of the Time, the only hour that ever was, ever will be, or that ever is. This is the hour during which you will decide your future
and thus our collective futures. Tonight we have a very special guest with us, and we're going to be talking about suppressed technology that was developed many years ago and has been kept hidden from the general population of not only this country, but the world. We've talked a little bit about this on other episodes of The Hour of the Time, but tonight we're going to go back to the origins. We're going to talk about it in depth, where it came from, who's developed it, is it real, is it not real. And by now, those of you who have been listening to this show for some time probably have realized that once again we're going to talk about UFOs. I first met this gentleman during my lecture tours several years ago, when I began to notice that right in front of my podium in the first row, the same gentleman seemed to be following me around the country and always had very penetrating questions to ask. We eventually struck up conversation, got to know each other, and I found that behind the beard was a very good brain that was working all the time. Some of his research has paralleled mine, and he certainly knows a lot more about some parts of this mystery than I do. And that's what we want to get at tonight. We want to sort of pick his brain and get to what he knows about this mystery called UFOs. His name is Vladimir Terzisky, and he is originally from Bulgaria. And Vladimir, welcome to the Hour of the Time.
Thank you very much, Bill. I'm very happy to be a part of this great show, probably one of the best shows on the West Coast.
Thank you.
Definitely a non-American show, without any commercials, intellectual show that would make people to think. Something that seldom happens here. More easily one can find such a show in Europe, for example.
Well, you know a lot about that because you come from a country that was traditionally, you weren't allowed to have any freedom of speech at all, were you?
And that's exactly how we learned to look for good shows. We would listen to Radio Moscow, we would listen to Radio Vatican, to the BBC, to Voice of America, to Deutsche Welle, and we would compare their versions of the story. And this is how people in Eastern Europe learn the ABC of practical conspiratology, how the lies are put together with widespread. Never, ever the versions are totally coincidental. Always there would be a little difference.
Uh-huh. How did you get to be in the United States? What brought you here, Vladimir?
Well, I came as a political refugee in 85. Spent a year in a refugee camp in Vienna. Studied German at the Vienna University at the time. Waiting for my visa. Arrived in Arizona in 85. Studied 1 year of sociology at the Arizona State University and continued for two more years at UCLA. But what brought me here was my dissatisfaction with my own country after spending 4 years of studies in Japan. I studied physics and engineering at Tokai University from 1974 to 1980. Coming back from Japan into an Eastern European country, and Bulgaria in particular, fights with Romania for the place before the last place in Europe, just ahead of Albania, as the least developed European country, so the shock, the cultural and technological shock would be tremendous for someone coming back from Japan into such country.
Certainly. Let's get into the subject of tonight's talk. Where in history have you found the first real technology that may have led to what we now call unidentified flying objects, flying saucers, UFOs, all these different names that people have labeled these things that we see in the air?
Well, Bill, just with three sentences, my interest in UFOs was exploded while I was in Japan. Japan is an extremely open society about UFOs. On primetime television, one would see documentary films that would never be shown in the United States, from all over the world, from Australia, from the United States, from Europe. And being an engineer and being fascinated as a small child with aviation, I developed a very deep interest into the anti-gravity part of the UFO equation. How the hell do these things fly? I remember the first ever volume of the encyclopedia I picked up when my father subscribed for the Great Russian, or the Great Soviet Encyclopedia, was the volume on aviation. This was my first encyclopedic search before I ever went to primary school. I was 5 at the time. I've been fascinated with flying contraptions. So after I developed my interest in UFOs in Japan, that was in the late 70s, after arrival in the United States in 85, I started avidly reading books, journals about UFOs, collecting a vast video library. I have about 200 documentary films about UFOs from all over the world. I'm fluent in Japanese, Russian, German, English, and I can read technical texts in some other European languages, so I don't have any problem for using documentaries from these countries. And about a year and a half ago, I heard the first rumors that the Germans had developed some anti-gravity flying machines of a circular or lenticular form that we colloquially call flying saucers. I've been fascinated with anti-gravity before that, and I thought that I have discovered some of the big secrets, quote-unquote, of anti-gravity. Subsequently, I realized that the Germans have utilized all these secrets in very simple engineering devices that took off successfully and were tested before the war ended.
Was there is there any hint of this going back farther in history? I know during the 1800s, in the newspaper accounts in the United States, there are stories of a giant, basically giant, nobody really knows how big this thing was, but it was an airship that went across the country.
Goat airship.
Well, not goat, because this thing actually landed. People got out and talked to people. It can be found in
Yeah, that's the label they use about them in the UFO literature, but it's a very important question about how technology is generally developed on a planet. I'm of the opinion that secret societies, hermetic sciences, secret brotherhood have been safeguarding, developing, and using elite knowledge that has not been accessible to the general public for the last 5,000-6,000 years. So I would say nothing new under the sun. It is not the Germans that developed anti-gravity first. The first report about a workable flying anti-gravity machine that I heard was of the American John Keely, a genius of the Tesla and Schauberger type, that lived in the late 1800s. In the early 1860s, he demonstrated a working anti-gravity platform to the war ministry. It was a device the size of a bathtub with a lever, control lever, sticking on top of it. He put a chair on top of that device, sat in the chair, pulled the lever forward, the device rose silently, noiselessly, then pulled the lever further forward, and it accelerated at tremendous speed horizontally, then stopped at a dime, came backwards, and landed. All of it noiselessly. Keely never fell off the chair. The chair was not bolted to the device. The guys from the war ministry scratched their smart heads and said, well, now we don't see any reason for any purpose for this device in the future. So this is the story of John Keely is a genius of a very rare kind. There's a John Keely Society in Colorado. Anyone who's interested in this rare literature, I will be glad to provide information later on. My phone number in Los Angeles is 310-473-9717, and I will repeat it one more at the end of the show. But the John Keely Society provided me with incredible information. Actually, he created a whole science of sympathetic vibration, something that has been later expurged from the libraries. John Keeley, as a name, is not found in any database. It's not mentioned in any library. The guys from the John Keeley Society have discovered copies of some of his drawings that obviously come from a book. They have page numbers, but the book, they've never been able to locate the book itself. The books have been removed by the Thought Police from the university and other public libraries. They may still be found in some private collections or in some dusty attic. John Keeley created other things, including free energy devices. He built a 250 horsepower free energy locomotive. He built incredible tunnel boring devices that were using sound. We can call him the genius of sound vibrations. Through masterful manipulation of sound, one can attain mastery of the lower classes of energies and of matter. Obviously, it's my understanding that there are hierarchical levels of energies in the universe. The few interactions that we know of physics, the four, and we speculate about the fifth, the gravitational, the electromagnetic, the weak and the strong interaction, and now physics speculates about the fifth, the opposite of gravitational force. These are just a small fraction of the large number of energies in direction that interactions that exist in the universe. And John Keeley was able somehow to tap to one of these, the magic of sound. Another report that I know of the late 1800s is, of course, the information coming about Nikola Tesla. Nikola Tesla was another genius of the Keeley and Schauberger type. Someone who would receive his ideas in basically a finished vision. All he had to do is put the idea on paper, and then the guys in the shop had to put the paper into metal. And these things were always working. Tesla was fuming that, I'm sorry, Edison was fuming that Tesla never sweated in the shop, in the lab, but this was the nature of his genius. He was getting his ideas somewhere from the upper floors of the universe in a ready form. Anyway, Tesla worked extensively on so many numerous fields of physics, but we can call him the genius of electromagnetics, the oscillating electrical current that we use nowadays is probably the first and the smallest of Tesla inventions that he did in the 1870s, 1880s. What Tesla did after that had been successfully expurged from public libraries. His name has been downplayed. I've even seen photographs of his image airbrushed away from a photograph of a group of scientists at the Institute for Advanced Studies at Princeton, where Einstein happened to be in the same photograph. Obviously, if someone is in the same photograph with Einstein, then he is not just any scientist, he's a major scientist. Anyway, my feeling is that the stories about the Gulf airships of the late 1800s are probably true, that these have been secret engineering projects, let's call them black projects, financed through shady financiers, private financiers, by the bankers and the Illuminati and the secret societies behind the scenes. The fictional book Genesis and its prequel Inception by Harbinson are, in my opinion, a very true story, in my humble opinion, a true story of how these secret societies develop new technologies that are never divulged to the public, at least for 50 years. In that story, they have the creation of airships way before the turn of the century. They even mentioned the existence of a turboprop biplane that crossed the Atlantic before the Wright brothers' plane flew. They even intimate that the Tunguska explosion in, I think, 1905 or 1908, somewhere there, was actually an explosion of a crude nuclear-powered flying device of a saucer shape that was created by a brilliant American scientist named Wilson. Of course, two-thirds of this fictional novel is about the research and development in anti-gravity and the creation of a large family of flying saucers in Germany before and during the Second World War.
Is there any evidence that this man Wilson actually lived?
This may be a cover-up for another real person that lived. On the other hand, it's a good question to see whether Harbison himself knows German. I have a little suspicion that he just published a brilliant book. He never followed with anything for 10 years. And if he doesn't know German, then it would be obvious for me that he just got this material as a big, thick file from somewhere. We all know from where. And he was asked to write one nice book, probably a bestseller, because this is one of the many skeletons in the closet of the secret societies and the government black forces that they won't eventually be taken out to the public. That they want to wash one more piece of dirty laundry.
Do you think Genesis may have been something like Missing Time or Majestic by Strieber?
Yes. In my opinion, the book Genesis, because the part of Genesis that I investigated thoroughly, the part about the German flying saucers, turned out to be many times beyond what was discussed in Genesis. I mean, the Genesis was a gross understatement of the German anti-gravity research and development effort.
Let's go to one more item.
So Tesla is known to have developed anti-gravity using an electromagnetic principle. John Keely developed anti-gravity using vibrational sound techniques. And I have a suspicion that both of these anti-gravity devices were free energy devices, namely flying transformers of energy that would transform types of energy that we have not discovered, we know very little about yet, into energy that we know about a little bit more, and we can use as mechanical work. I mean, electricity or just mechanical work. So I have a feeling that some of these airships of the late 1800s were the first experimental devices utilizing the lift of hydrogen and possibly helium. And I also have a suspicion that they may have had some hybrid anti-gravity drives installed in them because of the strange designs that I see. I tend to believe in drawings when I see them in the paper because people's eyes are a very good optical image processing and data storing mechanism, in my opinion. Early at the turn of the century, there have been many reports, 14 reports, the latest of them I read in one of the latest issues of Fate magazine, about flying saucers being noticed in many parts of the United States, landing and people talking in plain American English and wearing Navy uniforms. I have a feeling that these are the first and secret black project anti-gravity vehicles developed with Tesla technology by the Navy, for the Navy, financed by the secret societies and the bankers. So we see a whole line of secret sciences developed. These are not all the secret sciences that are developed by the secret society. This is less than 5%, less than 1% of the secret sciences that are developed in parallel in faraway farms by shady financiers, by crazy scientists. My feeling is that probably all the films, that science fiction films that we've seen about crazy scientists in Frankenstein in labs are exactly that. Secret black projects financed by the racial secret society. So by the time the Germans came to power, I have found at least 5 instances of anti-gravity craft developed on this planet. The latest instance is the lenticular aerodyne by Henry Coander, Frenchman. I have an engineering drawing of this device. And I repeat, anyone who's interested in more information can give me a call, write me a letter, and I will send full information, faxes, Xerox copies of the drawings and so on. I have several videos on the topic. Coanda's ventricular iodine utilize a hybrid helicopter propeller lift and anti-gravity lift. It was powered by turbojet and ramjet. It was an invention that preceded its time with at least 10, 15 years. So by
what,
the time...
What time frame are we talking about?
1930.
Okay.
Coanda's lenticular iodine. And my feeling is that by the time the Hitler came to power, it was well established in the scientific community of the secret society that anti-gravity is extremely easy to obtain. That simple spinning of an object would produce anti-gravity. I came in a roundabout way to the research of German flying saucers. Initially, I started an anthropological study of anti-gravity, simply collecting stories, myths, and legends about anti-gravity flying contraptions from different places and times, from academics, from tabloid sources, from ancient astronauts, stories from modern-day contactee accounts, from revelatory books, and so on.
What's the most interesting story that you collected?
actually, the most funny story that I collected was about, it came from a Russian officer, a Russian lieutenant major, two-star officer, who met some extraterrestrial while walking past the Siberian lake. They invited him for a joyride, poked his brain without any pain. It was a joyride experience, not a forceful abduction. He consented to that and was extremely happy. At the end, they wanted to delete his brain because this is, well, the code of the universe. You do not leave any traces of your visitation. He didn't want to part with this pleasurable experience, so with his typical cunning Russian deceitfulness of a cunning Russian peasant, he started desperately to try to find a way to deceive them. And he came with a very usual plot. What else but vodka? So he said, you know, guys, upon parting, we have a very well-established custom. We always drink with our friends. Great. So what do you drink? Well, we drink vodka. What is vodka? He had hard time remembering the chemical formula of alcohol from his high school days. Then he wrote, they told him he can write with his finger on the wall of the craft and use it as a blackboard. He wrote the formula. They quickly synthesized the liquid, came back with a strange-looking cup, only one cup, and gave it to him. He asked him, well, aren't you going to drink with me too? And they said, oh, no, no, no. If we were to drink this liquid, we would have never reached this level of evolution that we are on right now, but you can drink it. So he quickly drank the liquid. When they put him on the bench to delete his memory, they figured, came the puzzled voice of the operator of the console. He said, I don't know what to delete. All his centers of brain activity are brightly lit, obviously because of the vodka. So he just deleted whatever he thought were the memories of his abduction experience, and they were mistaken. They deleted parts of his childhood experiences. He forgot some missing months of his army service and so on, but he remembered this whole abduction and the whole joyride. And the answer to his question, well, how do flying saucers fly? He said, well, the agent said, oh, very simple. It's a spinning nuclear reactor. By dipping in and taking out the control rod, you control the lift. It's one big reactor that spins along a vertical axis that creates the big lift that takes us away from the planet, and another small reactor that rotates on a horizontal axis that creates the horizontal propulsion to move us across the horizon. And many other stories, but this is probably one of the funniest stories of a failed, how should I say, mind deletion, of a failed missing time experience. My anthropological study of myths and legends about anti-gravity spanning over several thousand years of terrestrial history has found one common denominator of all stories about anti-gravity myths, namely that simple spinning would create anti-gravity. One does not need fancy alien hardware, incredible software. Spinning of any material body fast enough would reduce its weight when a certain critical rotational velocity is reached, the body flies away. Then the question is how to better achieve this spinning with the existing engines of the time. And this is exactly the question that the German engineers were confronted with. And basically they use every existing engine of the time. I have discovered drawings, sketches and stories of flying saucer devices powered by gasoline engines with propellers, powered by Wankel engines with propellers. I even have a suspicion that the very Wankel engine itself was created to power a flying saucer.
You're talking about what we call a Wankel?
Wankel, yeah, the Wankel. Its rotational symmetry, it can be used to spin the craft one way while the piston inside spins the other way. There's a question of balancing that I haven't figured out yet, but this is just a suspicion of mine. Beyond the internal combustion engines, the Germans used any other engine that they had. They tried turbojet engines, pulse jet, ramjet engines, and rocket engines. They tried them in an outboard configuration and an inboard configuration. We know from the history of German aviation
You're listening to the Hour of the Time. I'm William Cooper. This is a broadcast originally recorded on July 27, 1992 in a hotel room in San Diego, California, where I was speaking and where Vladimir Terzisky, the person being interviewed, came to hear me speak. And I actually taped four broadcasts, which were never aired, ladies and gentlemen, have never been aired. You're hearing this material for the first time. Nobody's ever heard it before. I'm hearing it for the first time since it was taped. I have not played these since they've been taped. I can't remember why they didn't air. And it's fascinating. It's interesting. And I don't believe all of this stuff, and neither should you. Remember, listen to everyone, read everything, believe absolutely nothing unless you can prove it in your own research. But it's interesting. And I happen to know that Vladimir Terzisky is a very, very intelligent, very, very highly educated young man. And so here's part two of tonight's hour.
While the piston inside spins the other way. There's a question of balancing that I haven't figured out yet, but this is just a suspicion of mine. Beyond the internal combustion engines, the Germans used any other engine that they had. Heinkel, I think, 211 people fighters was built hastily in a few months, and it had the engine sitting on top of the fuselage. So hasty outboard engine attachment is nothing new to anyone who is well aware of the advanced research and development in aviation, standard aviation. Later on they developed inboard engines. I would mention several of the models that were built by the Germans. Actually, the first model that they built was the flying saucer built by Schrieder in the early 40s, 40-41. It was a hybrid model between a helicopter lift and an anti-gravity lift. The thing looked like a giant Ferris wheel, 15 meters diameter, about 45 feet diameter disc, spinning along a vertical axis. The cabin was in the center of the whole creation. gyroscopically stabilized so that the pilots would not spin into insanity with the whole craft. And around that cabin, we had this huge disc spinning. The disc had multiple helicopter propeller blades that could change their pitch in order to control for the lifting power. And the information that I have is that at a time of takeoff or sharp angle high G maneuvers, the needed RPMs were around 1500-1600, while at a steady state horizontal speed or hovering, it could get by with only 600 RPMs per minute. This wheel was spun into action initially by turbojet engines. The Germans utilized the standard Messerschmitt 262 jet fighter engine developed by one of them was developed BMW, the other one was developed by Junker, the UMO 002 engine. Three engines were spinning the disc around the vertical axis, and two more engines attached under the stationary cabin were propelling the whole device forward. Later on, of course, the first attempt crashed because of tremendous wobbling and vibrations. They were not able to fine-tune and eliminate the vibrations of this huge spinning construction. Later on, they solved the problem, and the first disc reached a speed of 2,000 kilometers an hour, about 1,300 miles an hour, almost twice the speed of sound. The rumor is that even Air Marshal Göring rode one of the discs. Later on, the Germans attached rocket engines, particularly the Walter rocket engine, and several variations of it that increased the horizontal speed to 3 and subsequently 4,000 kilometers an hour, which is more than three times the speed of sound. Probably these were small bursts of speed because my feeling is that these initial prototypes were probably made of the same duraluminum that they were using for their standard turbojet plane. So if they were to push the craft too hard, they would have simply melted it in the atmosphere.
And in what year did this occur?
The Schiller disc was tested from early 40s, 40, 41, until 44, 45. Later models dispensed entirely with the helicopter lift and relied only on the anti-gravity lift created by the spinning hull. The very hull of the saucer was spinning. Only the cabin in the center of the craft was kept stationary by gyroscopes.
And when you say anti-gravity, Vladimir, are you talking about something that another force that actually opposes or negates the force of gravity, or is this just creating another energy force that... You're talking about a spinning mass.
Yeah.
Creating some force that allows this to rise into the air.
Well, gravity, anti-gravity, energy, electrons, mass, these are all labels, physical variables, but these are just primitive labels that we attach to things in nature that we are trying to understand. Higher and more advanced races will probably heartily laugh at our primitive attempts, more or less wrong. But still, we are trying to have some clarity. My feeling is that all these labels are just convenient metaphors and tools of our mind. When I say anti-gravity, let's say that I just mean the ability to negate the pull of gravity, the ability to...
Without the conventional methods that we're used to, such as an airfoil or helicopter blades or something of that nature.
Yeah. Still, I have to repeat that the first models, as usual, were hybrid models. Always when we create something new, it would be a hybrid and it would incorporate features of the old and preceding model or technology. But later on, they got rid of the helicopter aerodynamic lift propeller blade entirely for the spinning heavy mass of the fuselage of the body of the craft that was creating this anti-gravity lift. My feeling is that when a heavy, massive object is turned around a vertical axis, it probably drags around itself the fabric of space-time. Modern physics would stay away from the word ether because Michelson and Morley prove that ether doesn't exist. But the word fabric of space-time would be used, or vacuum, papers on energy from...
Well, we know there must be some vacuum. Fabric of space, because physics agrees that space can be bent. If you can fold space, there must be something to fold.
Yeah,
correct.
Even in very serious physics journals, like Physical Review Letters and Nature and other journals, you will see, little by little, articles about getting energy from vacuum, which is probably from the fabric of space time, which is probably from ether, and very convenient labels. But my feeling is that working anti-gravity drives probably drag and spin around themselves the fabric of space-time, creating an etheric vortex, a whirlwind.
So you said something that I find very interesting. You said the fabric of space-time, and it's always been my contention that these machines are time machines. What do you think?
A very good point. They may introduce little distortions in time that an accurate time, atomic time clock would measure as an artificial satellite that has a time atomic time clock on board would measure a little delay in time. Even an atomic time clock spun around the globe on a standard passenger jet plane would show a little delay. So
sure,
they do interfere with space-time. But if you're talking about a practical time machine that would take us back home, backwards or forward in time, it would take a little bit more hardware and gadgetry. But it is still easily attainable. My feeling is that these are technologies that were attained by both the Germans and country's government almost half a century ago. But this would be a topic of an entirely different discussion. So coming back to the German flying machine, the next an important model that was built was probably one of the most famous of all models, the so-called Kugelblitz, or the Krautball, as it was jokingly called by the Allied pilots, or the Kraut Meteor,
or Foo Fighter,
Foo Fighter. The name came probably from the way these machines were swooshing by many times faster than the speed of the lumbering bombers. A bomber would make 300-400 kilometers an hour. A Messerschmitt would make 650. A Foo Fighter would make 1500, 2000, 2900 kilometers an hour. For them, bombers were sitting ducks. Even fighters were sitting ducks. So the name Foo Fighter is a very good name. It just conveys the image of the idea of the situation, how fast these machines were pushing by. Renato Vesco, who is the, let's call him the Italian Werner von Braun, the research and development boss of the Italian Air Force before and during the Second World War, and his brilliant book that was also kind of removed from the libraries and has been stopped from publication. The book is called Intercept But Don't Shoot, or Intercept UFO, originally published in Italian and probably shortened in its British release, even more shortened in its American release.
I have a copy of this book and I've read it, and he says basically the same thing that you're saying.
Exactly. In his book, he traced the whole development of anti-gravity in Germany, but he stopped short of many interesting developments. He is basically talking about the lower 1, 2, 3 levels of the research and development pyramid, omitting the most interesting top levels, top tiers of research. In that book,
don't you think that in the position that he occupied with the Italian government, that it was probably wise of him to do that? Maybe he couldn't write more. What he wrote about was incredible to me, and he documented every bit of it. I mean, he listed the...
He knew what he was talking about.
Yes, absolutely.
And he's a brilliant physicist and engineer. This is a highly technical book written in a popular language by someone who is a physicist and engineer, no doubt about that. And there he mentions about 3,000 accounts of attacks of two fighters on Allied bomber formations with devastating consequences for the bombers. I mean, it was no matching game.
These Foo Fighters didn't really shoot at the bombers.
Well, they were so advanced they didn't have to shoot.
What they did was totally annihilate the electrical system.
Exactly. At the beginning, they were just holding the bombers. So the Germans were ironing out the following a bomber formation without getting too close, without staying too far away. These were remote controlled weapons platform, vertical takeoff. They had remote television navigation, remote sensing, acoustic, electromagnetic, infrared sensing that were 10, 15, 20 years ahead of their time.
Yes.
They could automatically escape when fired upon. So when the attacks began, these Kugelblitzes were using extremely strong electromagnetic radiation to fry the amplifiers, the receivers of the Allied bomber radars, to blind them so that they couldn't find their goals. Later on, they mounted even more powerful Klystron tubes that were creating such monstrous electromagnetic fields around them. They were comparable to the electromagnetic pulse after a nuclear bomb. These tubes were powerful enough to dampen and to nullify the electrical currents in the electrical circuitry of the bombers flying nearby, so that their engines were cut out because of no more sparks in the pipeline. And the moment the Kugelblitzes would separate and fly away, the engines would restart. They would come again, the engines would die out. This is actually how the book's genesis starts, with a crash of an Allied bomber after an attack by a Kugelblitz.
And this is well documented, not by pilots, I think the Kugelblitz is one of the most, besides the V-2 bomber and the Buzz bomb, is probably the most well-documented secret weapon the Germans had. There's no doubt that they had these.
The Kugelblitz and the Feuerball.
Right.
The two secret flying balls that were hanging like Christmas tree ornaments, like glowing orbs in the skies of Germany before they started attacking the bombers. They had a manned version of the Kugelblitz. And the funny thing is that it's a very simple weapon. It was a kerosene-burning turbojet-powered device. I'm not sure whether they carried their oxidizer on board or not. They were either air-breathing air from the atmosphere, or carrying the oxidizer on board. But basically, they used the same materials, the same fuel, the same navigation as they were using for their fighter planes, although with incredible speed. The ionization layer around the Kugelblitz was effectively negating the aerodynamic resistance of the atmosphere, bringing it down to almost zero. That's why they could attain these incredible speeds even inside the atmosphere.
Was the ionization layer what caused this brilliant light?
Yes, exactly. They were using some additives to the fuel that would increase the ionization coefficient, and the ionization would reduce, it would work as a lubricant around the craft, almost reducing to zero the head aerodynamic resistance. We can talk for hours about the Kugelblitz. I've collected so much information on it. I even think that I have a very good photograph of a Kugelblitz in flight. The funny thing is that the photograph was taken in 1952 over Mount Rainier in Washington State. And my suspicion is that this Kugelblitz may have been tested, test flown out of the secret British research and development facility, a huge city for 50,000 people that was built in
Western Canada
in British Columbia.
And this is the direction from which the first big flying saucer flap came from, the nine saucer
formation that right. Kenneth Arnold saw.
Right.
And Renato Vesco in his book even mentions that when some of these saucers that Kenneth Arnold saw crashed, some porous metal was found at the crash site. The porous metal, what the Germans called the Luftschaum, the air foam, was exactly the porous metal with these microscopic, micron size or whatever size, miniature size, pore holes that were
like a beehive.
is thinner than that,
yeah.
smaller than that.
I didn't mean to say beehive. I meant to say honeycomb. What's honeycomb?
It was actually one of the first composite materials made with sintered with powder metallurgy. I mean, the Germans were not only advanced aviation technology, but they developed powder metallurgy that was ahead of its time, and metals that were ahead of the time with more than 100 years. The so-called metal, the impervium, that was harder than diamond, was developed by them and using these machines later on. I heard stories that a piece of impervium was held toward a diamond grinding wheel, or put on an electric motor, electric diamond grinding wheel, until the wheel started glowing red hot because of the frictional temperature coming out of the friction between the impervium and the wheel. But the impervium never melted and never ever was anything grounded away from it.
So these stories
about harder than diamonds.
So these stories about crash flying saucers where they couldn't cut the metal and they couldn't burn the metal, that doesn't mean that that it wasn't made here. What you got described
I don't want to say that all crash craft on this planet were made by the Germans. Maybe some of them were
either, because we don't know
that.
But we do know. That we have developed this technology.
But the whole set of technologies needed for a crash this scenario, or even a little gray abduction scenario, were created by the Germans 50 years ago and have been in the government arsenal of all superpowers for half a century.
Sure.
So going back to the German disc, after the Kugelblitz and the Feuerball, which is the second version of the Kugelblitz, and it was the main version, the Germans developed their first enlarged joint, the mega project, the Bellonsomitisch Fever Disc, which was their first operational fighter saucer. It was a standard turbojet craft. Turbojet saucer using low-grade aviation kerosene. At the end of the war, the Germans had a very low-grade gasoline. I mean, they were running on octane numbers that few Allied machines would ever move.
So it turned out to be a boon for everyone because jet fuel, because of that, eventually turned out to be nothing more than a version of kerosene.
Exactly, and it's non-explosive. It's a lot less explosive than gasoline. Otherwise, we would have had a lot more Hindenburg-type crashes of airplanes. So the Bellonsomitisch Fever disc was, again, a disc about 15 meters diameter, about 45 feet diameter. At the beginning, they tried 8 turbojet engines of the UMO, I think 002 type, the standard jet used in the Messerschmitt 262 fighter plane. And it
which was for the benefit of our listeners, was the first fighter plane.
Turbojet.
Right.
Operational turbojet fighter plane. Actually, the Heinkel 179 was the first turbojet plane that ever took off. It happened in the summer of 1939. 3-4 years before the first British.
This is incredible that the first jet-powered aircraft took off in 1939.
Exactly.
But operational jet aircraft weren't in the air actually fighting until almost the very end of the war. Well, let me ask you something.
Take some time for research. Sure. I mean, the fighter planes of the Second World War, the Messerschmitt, they've been developed for 10 years before that.
But look at the Japanese. I bet the Japanese, if they had that, they wouldn't spend time for research because they were sending pilots up in the air to go to their death as the guidance system for bombs. The pilot actually was the guidance system for flying bombs that they would just fly right into our ships.
I agree, but still they had extensive research before the war too, and they got a lot of information from the Germans, including up to the very last months of the war. Even after the war ended in Germany, they were still getting, with the huge German transport submarines, bizarre flying contraptions, including disassembled flying saucers that were assembled, according to an eyewitness account of a Japanese engineer that worked for a Mitsubishi aircraft factory. They assembled a strange device push the button, it flew away. They got so scared they dynamited the other device, or that's what they said. Said their prayers, and it was the end of the journey.
That was the end of it.
Anyway, so
I can't see the Japanese getting scared and running away, but that's okay.
No, you're raising a very valid question. Why it took so long for the turbojet to be developed? You know, I mean, the first turbojet plane was probably a 10-minute flight, 10-day repair situation, or maybe a month of repair.
Well, I would say the biggest problem was being able to carry enough fuel to stay in the air for long enough to get to it.
Not only the fuel. I mean, everything would be leaking. The gas turbine would wear down very fast. The ball bearings would melt and so on. These things could hardly stay in the air for 15 minutes without developing any trouble, while the piston fighters could fight for hours without major failures because they had already from, First World War, 1914, about 25 years of extensive history.
I've got to interrupt. This is fascinating. I've got to tell you, this is absolutely fascinating, and I know that our listeners are just as fascinated as I am, and I know an awful lot about this, but still...
It's the tip of the iceberg. We haven't even cracked it.
And what we're going to do is, would you consent to come back and do maybe one or two more shows, and then so that we can
get
more into this? Great. I can't tell you how happy it makes me to have someone who has this kind of knowledge on this show. It's something that everybody needs to understand, that technology has been developed in secret and withheld from the common man for so many years that a lot of, well, for instance, in the United States right now, every year the United States government spends $90 billion, that's billion with a B, dollars on research.
On black project research, and another $30 billion on black project research.
And where is the results of all of this research over the years?
And how much of the drug money proceeds go to black project research too? And the printing press funny money going to black project research too?
One of my favorite subjects. Well, we can't continue it on tonight, so as always, dear listeners, good night. And God bless you all. Why didn't I air that 5 years ago when it was taped? I should have. I can tell you that right now. That was incredible, interesting stuff. And there's three more hours of it. I think we're just going to plug that in for the next three Friday nights. Now, don't get Vladimir wrong. He does believe in extraterrestrials, and maybe some of that will come out. I truly don't remember, ladies and gentlemen, but whatever comes out will come out. And I guarantee that whatever it is, you will be held spellbound, fascinated, and you'll be entertained and educated all at the same time. Remember, ladies and gentlemen, listen to everybody, read everything, believe absolutely nothing unless you can prove it in your own research. And that goes for what you hear from me, your mother, your priest, your teacher, your professor, the President of the United States, the local police chief, I don't care who it is. You prove it yourself. There are so many people telling so many lies that it's absolutely pathetic. I think what you've heard tonight is closer to the truth than anything you've ever heard regarding advanced technology and UFOs and flying saucers and all of those kinds of things. Until Monday, good night, folks. God bless each and every single one of you. A weird bell, but a bell nevertheless, and it's tolling for you. And I advise you to listen. You're listening to the Worldwide Freedom Radio Network. We now return you to all oldies most of the time. Classic radio, like you always wished it could be.